The Bitchery of History is brought to you in partnership with Audible.com.
You can start your free trial and get a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
And I'm Allison, coming to you with a super sexy cold voice. You're welcome.
And I'm going to be talking to you this week about Sappho.
Fantastic. Yeah. I am going to be talking about Irina Sendler.
Ooh, I've never heard of her.
Get ready. Whole life is about to change.
Oh my God, I love it.
You are going to be crying. I'm sure of it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So Sappho is an ancient Greek poet, and by ancient, I mean Plato talked about her.
Holy
She's known as the 10th muse to the ancient Greek world. She's one of the 9 lyric poets of the ancient Greek world. She's actually one of the few female Greek poets of the ancient Greek world. And very, very little is known about her.
Well, I mean, records are probably a bit sketchy if Plato's writing your history.
Well, for the longest time, all we knew about her was from a grammar book called, are you ready for this? The Aeolic Dactylic Tetrameter Acatalectic.
Great.
Yeah. And it's a book of
Gesundheit.
It's a book of grammar that is used as some of her love poetry, but just like lines of it to explain how that kind of poetry was supposed to work in the ancient Greek world.
Okay.
And these are like ancient Greek grammar books that we're talking about here.
Right.
Right? In fact, we don't know that much about her until the mid-1800s when these archaeologists are digging in the desert and they come across, this is in Egypt, they come across these mounds of what they think is just like ancient trash. And as they're digging it up, they find a bunch of jewelry and stuff like that, but they also find just heaps of papyrus that had just been thrown out. And in there, we find all these scraps of poetry by Sappho.
Wow.
So Sappho is known throughout the Greek world. I mean, the fact that we know about her today, even though we know so little about her, tells you just how influential and how popular she was, especially because there was no writing at this time. The documentary I was watching talks about how, at this time, writing was a newfangled thing. And not many people knew how to do it or even knew what it was. And so it's
this young whippersnappers.
Exactly, with your
writing and your pencils. What are you doing over there?
So what we know, you know, quote unquote for sure, is that she was born around 615 BC to an aristocratic family on the island of Lesbos, which is the third largest island in the Greek archipelago. And it's believed that she had several brothers, at least 2. She married a wealthy man named Cerclias, and she had a daughter named Cleas. And we know this because she references them in her poetry.
Aww.
Her poems are very personal. Her poems are very, like, about everyday life. She talks about waiting for her brother to come back from war. She talks about the trials and tribulations of marriage and having children and all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
Right? It's all written from one person to another, talking from, like, in letter form, almost.
Wow. I bet these are beautiful.
They're really beautiful, especially because what we can tell from how the Greek would have been spoken at the time is very lyrical.
Right.
And so from using how it would have been spoken, they can kind of like suss out what it would have sounded like in terms of music, because all this poetry was done to music. And it is very, like, otherworldly. It's very cool. It's really interesting. I'll post the link to the documentary I was watching on the Facebook page. Absolutely. Throughout history, Sappho has been used, because there's so little known about her, Sappho has become this character who's kind of just been used to fit in your own political ideas, your own social ideas, kind of what Joan of Arc has become throughout the years.
Right.
And so she has been a religious leader, because some of her poetry deals with the gods and sings to the gods and religious cults and stuff like that. But at the same time, that was just part of life in the ancient Greek world. It was not out of the norm for, you know, everyday people to be singing, or the poet. That's what the poets did. They sang to the gods.
Yeah.
She was known as a degenerate because in the Greek world, in fact, that's one of the reasons they think a lot of her poetry doesn't survive to this day, is because a lot of the Greek poetry that we have was copied by monks and Islamic scholars who were sitting there by hand. And why would they devote expensive paper or vellum and ink to someone who was, first of all, a woman, and then a poet who was talking about lesbian relationships, about religious ideas that were not part of their culture and stuff like that. So, she today is known as like the first lesbian because of a lot of her poetry about love for women. And this was a practice in Greece where same-sex couples actually kind of formed the glue of Greek society. In fact, the documentary I was watching talked about how it was male homosexual relationships that formed the glue of wartime. Entire platoons of armies were made up by lovers, and they would go and they fight, right? It's and so you get these relationships where in ancient Greece, sometimes the love between two men was considered to be more real and more sacred than the love between a man and a woman, mostly because they thought that only men could experience true love in like an actual physical way. Yeah, her talking about this is the clearest evidence that we have that it wasn't just male-on-male love that was considered the most sacred. It was female-on-female love that was also part of that, too. Just that doesn't survive through the ages. Right. So, you know.
Well, hashtag women.
Right, exactly. So, some of the other things that we know about her, she appears on Athenian pottery a couple hundred years after she dies.
Whoa!
She is the only historical woman to ever appear on Greek pottery. This was an honor that was almost only given to Athenian pottery, ancient Athenian pottery, where you're talking about before the growth of Christ. It was to mythological characters, goddesses, and nymphs.
Oh, I guess I was going to say, I guess goddesses don't count.
Right. And this is the only person who we know existed in real life who appears. And it's not only, it's not just because we see her and we're like, oh, that must be Sappho. Her name is spelled out on the pottery.
Dang.
Right? That is how popular and amazing she was. And so she survives to this day. We have one. It's estimated, because of all the different lines that we have, that she would have written or could have written about 10,000 lines of poetry.
Holy goodness.
All we have that survives in its entirety to this day is one poem. It's about 21 lines.
That's it. Have one poem?
Yeah. And it was found by this anonymous collector, found it and gave it to people to study it, and he didn't even know what it was. And they found it because Sappho's brother is named by name in the poem, and the only person that they know who had that name in the ancient world was her brother. And because it was a poem,
where did this guy find it?
In that trash heap.
So it was like the archaeologist that found it.
Well, it was the archaeologist who found it, and then a private collector got his hands on it. And
okay.
Then he got it.
Got
to
it.
The
I'm just envisioning, you know, because you still even hear to this day some people who are like, yeah, I was cleaning out my Greek grandmother's desk, and I pulled out a drawer, and like, whoa, what do you know? Letters that Abraham Lincoln was writing. So I was just curious if he just, you know, walking through the island of Lesbos, hey, what's that paper under a rock? Whoa, it's a poem. Who knew that it could survive for 900 years?
Yeah. Actually, it was interesting because it was, like, you can tell that it was written on papyrus. And then at some point, it made its way from Greece to Alexandria, which is where it was found.
Right.
And then as it faded, the papyrus was turned into, like, a cardboard kind of, like, paper mache type thing to protect something else. I mean, they've found her poetry when they've been excavating tombs. Because the ancient Greeks would use like paper mache techniques, like sort of like our modern paper mache techniques, to make coffins, burial coffins. And so by pulling those apart, they've been able to find more poetry.
Oh, God. I just thought of the worst thing in the world.
What?
Well, grandma's dead. What are we going to do? I don't know. Wrap her in some old newspaper and poems. I'm sorry. But that's the only thing that could come into my mind.
And so that's really what we know of Sappho. It's a lot of very disparate information that forms this cohesive whole of this woman. Actually, to give you an example of her poems, this is one that she wrote about someone that she didn't like.
Okay.
But when you die, you'll lie there. And afterward, there will never be any recollection of you or any longing for you. Unseen in the house of Hades, you will go to and fro amongst the shadowy corpses.
And that, Sappho?
Savage.
Savage, but also Sappho, you be right. We don't know who that person is.
We don't.
We really don't.
We don't.
And honestly, we could probably care less.
Exactly. Right. So there's a couple stories as to how she died. There's two main ones. One, there's a legend. It's called the Leap of Sappho, where after some time, she falls in love with this ferryman. After all these years of writing poetry about loving women and all this stuff, around 300 to 400 years after she dies, customs start changing, and these men who are in power writing these stories about her, they have this story where she falls in love with this ferryman, and she tells him, and it's unrequited, and she leaps from the cliff and kills herself for love of a man.
I'm going to go ahead and give that a hard pass.
A hard pass, exactly.
Hard pass on that. Me too. I'm going to say no.
The historian who was talking about it in this documentary, she went, you know, as you do.
So true. Oh.
Many historians today believe that she died of old age in around 550 BC.
Yeah, probably.
At the ripe old age of 65, honestly. And I want to leave you with one last quote from Sappho. If you judge me by the divine muses, you will know that I escaped the gloom of Hades, and that no day will ever dawn that does not speak the name of Sappho, the lyric poet. And she's right.
Beyonce, you getting a run for your money.
Right?
That's what I'm going to say. That's amazing.
That's Sappho.
And I've never heard of her.
I hadn't either.
And I read Edith Hamilton's mythology cover to cover.
Right? It's on my bookshelf.
I don't know. Edith, you fell down on the job. Although I guess she's not a myth. She's real. So maybe that's a problem. So I'm going to talk to you about Irina Sendler.
Okay.
Get ready. All right. You're going to lose it. So Irina Sendler was born on February 15th in 1910 in Warsaw. And she worked prior to the outbreak of World War II for a social welfare department. And that was her job. Now, of course, being in Warsaw around that time,
things didn't go too well.
Things started going south.
Yeah.
So once the invasion happened, her whole life changed. The Nazis, of course, began herding Jews into the ghetto, and they built a wall separating it from the rest of the city. Of course, inside the ghetto, conditions are horrible, disease is running rampant, and social workers like Irina were not allowed inside the ghetto. So Sendler said, no, I'm going to find a way to get in there and make things better.
Good.
So she obtained a fake identification and said, oh no, I'm a nurse. You have to let me in.
Uh-huh.
So she brought in food, clothes, medicine, and did kind of as much as she could do.
Mm-hmm.
By 1942, however, everyone is like, oh, these Nazis are kind of,
Something's
is definitely really
here.
Not good,
yeah.
And we should do something. So she joined a Polish underground organization and recruited 10 close friends to join it with her.
Mm-hmm.
And this group would eventually grow to be 25, all but one of them women.
Mm. Yes.
And they began rescuing Jewish children from the ghetto. So what they would do as the Jews were being rounded up from the ghetto and being sent out to various camps, Sendler and the other people in her group began to talk to Jewish parents and say, please let your children go. Let us smuggle them out.
Mm-hmm.
You have to let them go.
Yeah.
And she was interviewed a few years ago. She's passed away since, but she said she still has nightmares about the encounters. And she said, quote, those scenes over whether to give a child away were heartrending. Sometimes they wouldn't give me the child. Their first question was, what guarantee is there that the child will live? I said, none. I don't even know if I will get out of the ghetto alive today. So what they did, taking all of this risk, they would smuggle children out in suitcases, in bags. Like, it was legitimate smuggling of children. If they were smuggling out infants or babies, they would sometimes sedate them so that they wouldn't be mm-hmm. crying. Mm-hmm. One of the other people who worked with Sindler in the Polish resistance said that the hard thing was there was nothing as horrible at the time as hiding Jews or harboring Jews. She said, quote, "No work, not printing underground papers, transporting weapons, planning sabotage against the Germans. None of it was as dangerous as hiding a Jew. You have a ticking time bomb in your home. If they find out, they will kill you, your family, and the person you are hiding." Mm-hmm. And she went on to describe about when she was running out of the ghetto with a small child under her arm. She said, "The street was blocked, so I ran through the gates I knew were still open with him under my arm, and we just managed to get to the apartment when they blocked it." So it was seconds.
Oh my God.
Absolute seconds.
My heart is racing.
So what they would do is some of these children were spirited away through basements, secret passages throughout the city. Mm-hmm. One of the children who was rescued and then went on to live a full and beautiful life, we assume, said that he was waiting by a gate in the darkness. A German soldier passed. He had then been told, once the soldier passes, count to 30. So he counts to 30, makes a mad dash to the middle of the street. A manhole cover opened up and he slips down inside of it. Boom. These women are on
super spies.
Super spies and super like, you gotta go right now.
Yeah. You have 30 seconds. You gotta win.
30 seconds or you're not gonna go. So most of the children who were rescued were taken into either Roman Catholic convents, orphanages, or other homes. They were given non-Jewish aliases, non-Jewish names, but she would write down and keep very careful track of a child's original name and then the name that she gave them. Because a lot of these kids are so young, of course. If you tell them at three, "No, your name is now Maria," or whatever it may be, they're not going to remember. So she kept very, very careful track so that when the war was over, she would be able to reunite them. And she kept most of these names in a jar. And what happened is she would have to bury this jar in the garden or hide it at a friend's house because, of course,
absolutely.
The Germans start getting a little
ticking
suspicious.
Time bomb, you've got an entire jar full of
a
ticking
jar
time bombs.
Full. So in 1943, she was captured by the Nazis and tortured, but she refused to tell them anything, where the bottle was buried, who was working with her. And she sometimes worked in the prison laundry as well. And as another sort of screw you to the Nazis, she mm-hmm. and her co-workers made holes in the German soldiers' underwear. And when the officers discovered what they had done, they lined up all the women. And they shot everyone. It was a very close call for her. I guess she didn't have to work in the laundry that day. Jesus. I don't know.
Oh, she survived?
She
wasn't
survived.
There that day?
She was not there that day. No! During one time when she was captured and tortured, her captors broke her feet and legs and she passed out. When she awoke, a Gestapo officer told her that he had accepted a bribe from some of her friends in order to let her escape. So he wrote her name down to a list of executed prisoners. And then she went into hiding, but continued to try and rescue people and continued her efforts.
She went right back to the fight.
Absolutely.
Good for her.
So before she joined this rescue operation, this resistance organization, Zagata, it's estimated that she had already saved about 500 people. Those were likely to be adults. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, or for the children, she is estimated to have rescued about 2,500.
Oh my God.
So ultimately, we believe that she helped rescue around 3,000.
Where's her
Polish
movie?
Jews. Just wait. So when the war ended, she dug up the jar and she began trying to return the children to their families. Of course, the vast majority, there is no family left.
Right.
So a lot of the children were adopted by Polish families. Some of them were sent to Israel. Some they've tracked down and interviewed. They live in New York. They live all over the world.
Yeah.
There is a movie that was made about her. It was a TV movie starring Anna Paquin.
Oh.
And I watched it when it came out. I'm totally going to mess up what year it was. I would say it's probably about 8 or 10 years old.
Oh, okay.
But I will say, and I remember it being very good, and Anna Paquin did a nice job. It is a TV movie.
Yeah. It's not Schindler's List.
It's not Schindler's List. It's also reported and kind of suspected that she was up for a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 when Al Gore actually ended up winning for his work on climate change. Of course, the Nobel Prize Committee, there's not really official nominees. You can't really know, but it was kind of suspected. And so a lot of people were upset that she didn't win and that it went to Al Gore. She passed away in 2008. On May 12th, she was 98 years old. And you've never heard that story?
No. I've heard a lot of other stories.
I'm sure you've heard a lot of other stories.
I've never heard that one. I mean, a group of women who were capering through the night, slipping open manhole covers, sneaking through. That's like an entire miniseries. You could make like an HBO series about that.
Absolutely.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
I really appreciate that.
Of course. The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can start your free trial and download a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
So the book that I want to recommend this week is We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
Shirley Jackson wrote that short story, The Lottery, if you ever read that in school.
No.
You probably did, but you don't remember.
Oh, okay.
It's like 2 pages long, maybe. And it's all the people that are gathering in the town square, and they're waiting for the name to be drawn for the lottery. And it's like this sense of excitement. And then a name gets drawn, and all these people have stones. And if your name gets drawn, you get stoned to death.
Oh.
You've never read this?
No.
It's a very famous short story.
Oh, okay.
Because
Why are they stoning people?
If I not for funsies. If I remember correctly, I believe it's a statement on overpopulation and is sort of set in a, I don't want to say post-apocalyptic, but more a future of like where The Giver is set, or maybe Divergent.
Sure.
Like everyone's trying to control the society and control this population.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, well, what are we going to do to keep our numbers down, guys? Let's have a yearly stoning. Why not?
Sure.
But We've Always Lived in the Castle is a really interesting book. It's on Audible, and you can get it at audibletrial.com/bitchery.
All right. So today in herstory.
On October 10th, 2014, Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai wins the Nobel Peace Prize in conjunction with the Indian child rights activist Kailash Satyarthi.
And then on October 11th, 1984, during a Space Shuttle Challenger mission, Catherine Sullivan becomes the first American woman to walk in space.
Go, girl.
Yes, ma'am.
On October 13th, 1967, President Lyndon B. Johnson issued Executive Order Number 11246, prohibiting sex discrimination in employment by the federal government and by federal contractors. So, actually, the term that I was going to talk about this week is not really a term. I did just finish reading the most amazing book. And it's the one that I recommended on Audible last week.
Okay.
All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Making of an Independent Nation.
Oh,
there's
right.
a lot of things in that book that we could discuss, but you're talking about male-male relationships and female-female relationships
sure.
in ancient Greece made me want to bring this point up, which I read, and it kind of broke my heart a little bit and gave me some hope, which is what that whole book does.
Interesting.
So get ready.
Yeah.
But there's sort of an idea, at least in American society now, that women are always in competition. You very rarely see in popular culture women working together as a team.
Absolutely.
It's always sort of a catty relationship, and they're in competition
with who wore it better.
Who wore it better. They're in competition to get a guy's love or to get a new job or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very new concept.
Yeah.
Prior to about the 1940s, 1950s, two women being best friends and having a closer and tighter relationship than a woman would have with her husband was completely normal and considered to be like, yeah, what do you mean you don't have your best friend, your wife,
right.
quote unquote?
Sure.
There was even a term for it. It's actually where we get the term Boston marriage. Kind of evolves out of that
okay.
to women being very, very close and not necessarily in a intimate or sexual relationship,
sure.
but just being absolute best friends.
Right.
And what that would also sometimes be called is they would be smashed. So two women who are best friends, like Beverly and I was texting
right.
her so many things. I'm like, we're married for real. You better believe it. They would be called being smashed.
Mm-hmm.
And so because marriage at that time in the 1700s, 1800s, and for a long time was essentially a social and economic contract, you are not going to get a lot of emotional support and companionship from your husband.
Right.
So it made perfect sense
absolutely
that your best friend would be your sister, a la Jane Austen and the Brontes, mm-hmm. or it would be someone else that you would really be close with and share a lot of your feelings with.
Right.
When this all changed is during World War II, we have a bunch of women going and working in factories.
Absolutely.
And then after World
War II,
exactly. After World War II in the early 1950s is when marriage starts again to become this big push, and there's a push to get women back into the household
right.
so that men can have their jobs
back. The glorious
back.
50s.
Absolutely. And that is when everyone was like, well, if women are being best friends with each other and spending all their time with each other, then they're not going out with men. That's where we start getting the term dating. You shouldn't be hanging out when you're a young woman with your
best
girlfriend.
When did the term smashed become drunk?
I don't know, because I've never heard that.
Oh, really?
To be meaning drunk. Oh. But also, I don't know a lot of things, and I have to use Urban Dictionary a lot, so that means pretty much nothing. It just means...
I'd be interested to find out when that term switched from being, like, two women that close to each other to meaning so drunk that you can't function.
Well, there's also this really interesting concept that women who were very sexual mm-hmm. and strong and independent started to be referred to using warfare terms. Bombshell, knockout. Mm. It's a poster of, I want to say Betty Davis, I may be incorrect, but a poster of her over the Bikini Islands,
is where
we get the term bikini.
Oh, I knew that. I knew that one.
So it's all interrelated. But point being, that's where we get the term dating, encouraging women to not spend their time with each other, but to spend their time with other young men. Because if you don't get married to him, if he picks somebody else, then you're screwed. You're not going to have the life that you want.
Right.
So that's then in the 1950s where we start seeing comics with women in competition with each other, like Archie, for example, mm-hmm. and in other just popular culture. So this idea now that we have of women always being catty with each other is only about 60 years old.
Huh.
So we need to go back.
We definitely need to go back.
To us all being best friends.
Let's all be best friends.
Because
let's all just get along.
Yeah, there is no competition. And that I was telling someone about this, and she said she has a friend who is a television writer, mm-hmm. a woman. And she said when shows are starting to staff up, mm-hmm. because they generally only are going to hire one woman, all of her friends who are writers, they just don't talk to each other for like 2 months.
Oh, wow.
During staffing, because it's such a fierce competition.
Yeah.
So you lose your network of support. And she said, of course, for the men, it's not the same. Because they're going to hire 9 men
sure,
and one
absolutely.
Woman. You can still hang out with your bros. But the women, it's like, no, I can't offer you.
I have to get to work. Yeah, I have to.
You know, any assistance or tips or help or say, oh, yeah, I interviewed with them last year. This is what they did. And I'm not saying that women don't do that or even that it's mean to not do that, because exactly, I have to get work. I have to pay my own bills.
Right, absolutely.
So
it's interesting. I mean, there are definite trends that we're kind of going back in that kind of direction. Mm-hmm. I mean, millennials are at this time in their lives compared to the generations that have come before, and especially if you go and look at that baby boomer generation mm-hmm. that came after World War II,
yeah.
millennials are not getting married. We're
yep.
not owning houses.
Yep.
We're not going into long-term relationships. I mean, most of this is because we can't afford any of it. But also, I think it's because we understand that there is more to life than marriage. There is...
Absolutely.
You can have relationships that are fully realized and fully in love and everything, and you don't need to call it marriage. You don't need to go through the legal act
right.
of being
right.
married.
But society is still set up to...
It is very much, yeah, absolutely.
...only support people who are married, which is why the gay marriage movement was so important. It was merely to get the rights that are afforded
exactly.
to people who are in a legally recognized relationship.
Absolutely. And people kept saying, why don't you get civil unions, civil unions, civil unions? Like, that's not the same. You can't,
yeah.
you don't have the same rights. You don't
and
have
exactly.
the same
it's not
death
necessarily,
benefits and
mm-hmm.
life benefits. Like, this isn't a religious thing for me. This is, there is a tax code in this country that
mm-hmm.
treats married people as one person and treats single people as one person. And that one person for married people is a lot more affluent, is in a completely
mm-hmm.
different tax
yep.
bracket.
Yep.
And so if you're going to deny me that, you're denying me... a civil right. You're denying me a basic privilege.
Absolutely. You should read this book. It'll blow your mind.
I want to borrow it when I return the other books I've borrowed from you.
It's from the library, so
oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I can't lend it to you.
I got one of those library cards. I can go myself.
That was the one of the very first things I did when we moved to LA.
Oh, absolutely.
I was like, I need a library card. I'm not going to survive.
My apartment didn't have internet for those 6 months that we moved here, so I was like, I got to get it somewhere.
I was getting books, not the internet, but that's okay.
Well, I did both. DVDs, books, everything.
Oh, man.
All right.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Yes, thank you so much. We here at the Bitchery of History are planning some very big things. And we wanted to let you know that there's not going to be a new episode because we're planning and scheming and getting ready to come back better than ever. So there's going to be a big announcement. Until then, stay in touch with the Facebook page. We'll still be on Instagram. Keep in touch through Patreon and email us your questions and your suggestions. If you want to talk, let's keep this conversation going.
You can do that at facebook.com/umpboh. Twitter and Instagram are the same handle, @umpboh.
You can also find us on our website at umpboh.com. You can also email us at umpboh@gmail.com.
Ooh, fancy.
Heyo. The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions, hosted by
Allison Powell
and Max Kirkham, along with
co-producer Chris McNeil.
And as always, bitches get stuff done.